From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Now, I have agonized over this vote, but I came to grips with it today, and I came to grips with opposing this resolution during the very painful, yet very beautiful memorial service. As a member of the clergy so eloquently said, as we act, let us not become the evil that we deplore.
Today, Barbara Lee. 20 years ago, she was the only member of Congress to vote against war in the immediate aftermath of the 9/11 attacks.
The death threats came. I can't even tell you the details of how horrible it is. People did some awful things during that time.
Now, the highest-ranking African-American woman in Congress. We'll speak to Barbara Lee, and then a conversation between Masuda Sultan. She is an Afghan-American woman. 20 years ago, she lost 19 members of her family. And Rita Lazar, she lost her brother, Abe Zalmanowicz, at the World Trade Center attacks.
And I looked out her window and saw the second plane hit the second building. And it dawned on me, my brother works there.
Your brother is a hero, and you're a hero for continuing his legacy. And it's amazing to me that someone who's lost so much isn't as revenge hungry as some of the other people that seem to want to, you know, go start bombing, you know, whoever, wherever.
All that and more coming back. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Joe Biden has laid out a 6-point plan to bring the U.S. COVID-19 epidemic under control after a summer that saw skyrocketing rates of infections, especially in areas with low vaccination rates. Speaking from the White House Thursday, Biden said he's ordering nearly all federal workers and contractors to get COVID-19 vaccinations or face weekly testing. He also said OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, will require large employers to have their workers inoculated or tested weekly. Violators face fines of up to $14,000 per infraction.
Despite the fact that for almost 5 months, free vaccines have been available in 80,000 different locations, we still have nearly 80 million Americans who have failed to get the shot. And to make matters worse, there are elected officials actively working to undermine the fight against COVID-19. Instead of encouraging people to get vaccinated and mask up, they're ordering mobile morgues for the unvaccinated dying from COVID in their communities. This is totally unacceptable.
The Republican National Committee immediately promised to sue the Biden administration over its vaccine mandates. South Carolina Republican Governor Henry McMaster tweeted, quote, "We will fight them to the gates of hell to protect the liberty and livelihood of every South Carolinian." The first international passenger flight out of Afghanistan's Kabul airport since the end of the U.S. withdrawal landed in Doha Thursday. The Qatar Airways plane held over 100 passengers, including Americans, Canadians and Britons. But the fate of many more who are still trying to leave Afghanistan, both foreign nationals and Afghans, is unknown. Meanwhile, there have been increasing reports of Taliban intimidation and violence against journalists, workers, activists, women and others. The U.N. said its Afghan staff have been subjected to threats, physical abuse, and some offices were looted. This is journalist Taki Dayabi, who was arrested while covering a women's protest in Kabul Wednesday and tortured in detention.
For about 10 minutes, about 7 or 8 people were beating us as much as they could. They would raise sticks and beat us with all of their strength. When they treat journalists like this, it's possible that journalism will stop in Afghanistan within a few months. It will be destroyed. What we want from the Taliban is for them to be responsible for the security and well-being of journalists.
The Syrian army entered the southern rebel-held city of Daraa on Wednesday for the first time in over a decade amidst a fragile Russian brokered truce. Daraa was the birthplace of the uprising against the government of President Bashar al-Assad in 2011. Human Rights Watch said civilians in the area are facing dire shortages of food, medicine, power and other basic necessities amidst a recent escalation in attacks by Syrian government forces and their allies. Meanwhile, the Syrian civil defense says at least five civilians were killed in government shelling attacks in Idlib province earlier this week. In immigration news, the Biden administration's extended temporary protected status, or TPS, by another 15 months for some 400,000 immigrants from Haiti, Honduras, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Sudan, and Nepal. This means they'll be able to continue working and living in the U.S. without the threat of deportation through December of 2022. Meanwhile, immigrant justice advocates continue to urge Congress to pass permanent immigration relief that includes a path to citizenship for TPS holders and millions of undocumented people in the U.S. In more immigration news, a whistleblower complaint is denouncing the ongoing abuse faced by unaccompanied migrant children held at the Fort Bliss military base in El Paso, Texas. BuzzFeed reports children were burned after bathing in blistering water, had their blood drawn without explanation, were constantly threatened with deportation. This is the third complaint detailing unsafe and brutal conditions at Fort Bliss, where the Biden administration set up large tents to hold thousands of unaccompanied migrant children. In Texas, the U.S. Supreme Court Wednesday stayed the execution of John Henry Ramirez, who says the state violated his religious freedom after it denied Ramirez's request to have his pastor hold his hand or touch him and pray with him in the death chamber. The Supreme Court will likely argue the case in October or November. The U.S. Justice Department has sued Texas over its near-total ban on abortions, calling it unconstitutional. The law, which bans abortions starting around 6 weeks of pregnancy, even in cases of rape or incest, circumvents the federal protection of abortion rights by deputizing private citizens to enforce it. This is Attorney General Merrick Garland.
Thus far, the law has had its intended effect. Because the statute makes it too risky for an abortion clinic to stay open, abortion providers have ceased providing services. This leaves women in Texas unable to exercise their constitutional rights and unable to obtain judicial review at the very moment they need it.
The Justice Department is seeking an injunction against the law. President Biden has withdrawn the nomination of David Chipman to head Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives. Chipman, a 25-year ATF veteran, was attacked by Republicans and the NRA for being a gun control advocate. And two Democrats, West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin and Montana Senator John Tester, would not commit to confirming Chipman, while Maine Independent Angus King, who caucuses with Democrats, said we would vote against his confirmation. The Newtown Action Alliance responded, quote, "The reason why there has been only one Senate-confirmed ATF director in the last 15 years is because the gun industry profits when gun laws are not enforced. David Chipman should have been confirmed," they said. Meanwhile, climate activists blasted Biden's pick of Willie Phillips to serve on the Federal Energy Regulation Commission. Phillips has represented oil and gas interests while working in corporate law. The Biden administration moved Thursday to permanently protect Alaska's Bristol Bay watershed from development, including a proposed gold and copper mine that would have destroyed the world's most productive sockeye salmon fishery. Environmentalists and indigenous groups in the region have long fought the proposed pebble mine, an open pit mine that would require construction of a massive power plant, natural gas pipeline, and huge toxic tailing ponds. In Massachusetts, Harvard president Lawrence Bacow said on Thursday his university will no longer invest its $42 billion endowment in fossil fuel companies. The announcement was a victory for the campus organization Fossil Fuel Divest Harvard, which was founded in 2012. The group tweeted, quote, "It took conversations and protests, meetings with administration, faculty, alumni votes, mass sit-ins and arrests, historic legal strategies, and storming football fields. But today, we can see proof that activism works. plain and simple, they said. And in labor news, Nabisco workers in five states remain on strike 1 month after workers at a Portland, Oregon plant walked off the job to protest management's demands for changes to work schedules and cuts to overtime pay. Some workers have been forced into 16-hour shifts during the pandemic. Others were asked to work 12-hour shifts 3 to 4 days a week, including on weekends. This is Nabisco worker April Flowers Lewis, who joined a picket line outside a Chicago plant in August.
We have a family just as well as the people in human resources and management. While we're working on the weekend and being forced, they're at home with their families. We can't even get a chance to enjoy birthday parties for our grandkids. We can't go away to see, take our kids to college because we're being forced to work. We can't enjoy our husbands, our spouses, because we're at work. By the time we get off work, it's go home, go to sleep, try to fix us something to eat, get into bed, and be back at work.
Meanwhile, in Buffalo, New York, workers at five Starbucks locations have joined an unprecedented push to unionize the coffee and fast food chain. Members of the newly formed Starbucks Workers United have filed petitions for union elections with the National Labor Relations Board. They say they faced an intense union-busting effort by Starbucks corporate executives. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Saturday marks the 20th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. In the days that followed, the nation reeled from the deaths of over 3,000 people as President George W. Bush beat the drums for war. On September 14, 2001, 3 days after the devastating 9/11 attacks, members of Congress held a five-hour debate on whether to grant the president expansive powers to use military force in retaliation for the attacks, which the Senate had already passed by a vote of 98-0. California Democratic Congressmember Barbara Lee, her voice trembling with emotion as she spoke from the House floor, would be the sole member of Congress to vote against the war in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. The final vote was 420-1.
Mr. Speaker, members, I rise today really with a very heavy heart, one that is filled with sorrow for the families and the loved ones who were killed and injured this week. Only the most foolish and the most callous would not understand the grief that has really gripped our people and millions across the world. This unspeakable act on the United States has really forced me, however, to rely on my moral compass, my conscience, and my God for direction. September 11th changed the world. Our deepest fears now haunt us. Yet I am convinced that military action will not prevent further acts of international terrorism against the United States. This is a very complex and complicated matter. Now, this resolution will pass, although we all know that the president can wage a war even without it. However difficult this vote may be, some of us must urge the use of restraint. Our country is in a state of mourning. Some of us must say, let's step back for a moment. Let's just pause just for a minute and think through the implications of our actions today so that this does not spiral out of control. Now, I have agonized over this vote, but I came to grips with it today, and I came to grips with opposing this resolution during the very painful, yet very beautiful memorial service. As a member of the clergy so eloquently said, as we act, let us not become the evil that we deplore. Thank you, and I yield the balance of my time.
Let us not become the evil we deplore. And with those words, Oakland Congressmember Barbara Lee rocked the House, the Capitol, this country, the world, the lone voice of more than 400 Congress members. At the time, Barbara Lee was one of the newest members of Congress and one of the few African-American women to hold office in either the House or the Senate. Now in her 12th term, she's the highest-ranking African-American woman in Congress. Yes, it's 20 years later, and on Wednesday this week, I interviewed Congressmember Lee during a virtual event hosted by the Institute for Policy Studies, which was founded by Marcus Raskin, a former aide in the Kennedy administration who became a progressive activist and author. I asked Congressmember Lee how she decided to stand alone, what went into that decision, where she was when she decided she was going to give her speech, and then how people responded to it.
Thanks so much, Amy, and really thanks to everyone, especially IPS, for hosting this very important forum today. And let me just say to those from IPS, for historical context and also just in honor of Marcus Raskin, Marcus was the last person I talked to before I gave that speech. The very last person. I had gone to the memorial and had come back. And I was on the Committee of Jurisdiction, which was the Foreign Affairs Committee, with this, where the authorization was coming from. And, of course, it didn't go through the committee. It was supposed to come up on Saturday. I got back to the office, and my staff said, you've got to get to the floor. The authorization's coming up. The vote is coming up within another hour or two. So I had to race down to the floor. And I was trying to get my thoughts together. As you can see, I was kind of not prepared, but I didn't have what I wanted in terms of my sort of framework and talking points. I had to just scribble something on a piece of paper. And I called Marcus and I said, okay. I said, you, and I had talked to him for the last 3 days. And I talked to my former boss, Ron Delms, who was, for those of you who don't know, a great warrior for peace and justice from my district. I worked for him 11 years. My predecessor. So I talked with Ron, and he's a psychiatric social worker by profession. And I talked to several constitutional lawyers. I've talked to my pastor, of course, my mother and family. And it was a very difficult time, but no one that I talked to, Amy, suggested how I should vote. And it was very interesting. Even Marcus did. We talked about the pros and cons, what the Constitution requires, what this was about. All of the considerations. And it was very helpful for me to be able to talk to these individuals, because it seems like they didn't want to tell me to vote no because they knew all hell was going to break loose. But they really gave me kind of, you know, the pros and cons. Ron, for example, we kind of walked through our background in psychology and psychiatric social work. And we said, you know, the first thing you learn in psychology 101 is that you don't make critical, serious decisions when you're grieving. And when you're mourning, and when you're anxious, and when you're angry, those are moments where you have to live, you have to get through that. You have to push through that. Then maybe you can begin to engage in a process that's thoughtful. And so Ron and I talked a lot about that. I talked with other members of the clergy and I don't think I talked to him, but I mentioned him at that because I was following a lot of his work and sermons. And he's a friend of mine, Reverend James Forbes, who is the pastor of Riverside Church, Reverend William Sloan Coffin. And they, in the past, had talked about just wars, what just wars were about. What are the criteria for just wars? And so, you know, my faith was weighing in, but it was basically the constitutional requirement that members of Congress can't give away our responsibility to any executive branch, to the president, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican president. And so I came to the decision that once I read the resolution, because we had one before, kicked it back, no one could support that. And when they brought back the second one, it was still too overly broad, 60 words. And all it said was the president can use force forever, as long as that nation, individual, or organization was connected to 9/11. I mean, it was just a totally abdication of our responsibilities as members of Congress. And I knew then that it was setting the stage for, and I've always called it forever wars in perpetuity. And so when I was at the cathedral, I heard Reverend Nathan Baxter when he said, let us be, as we act, let us not become the evil that we deplore. I wrote that on the program. And I was pretty settled then that going into the memorial service, I knew that I was 95% voting no. But when I heard him That was 100%. I knew that I had to vote no. And actually, prior to going to the memorial service, I was not going to go. I talked to Elijah Cummings. We were talking in the back of the chambers. And something just motivated me and moved me to say, no, Elijah, I'm going. And I ran down the steps. I think I was the last person on the bus. It was a gloomy, rainy day. And I had a can of ginger ale in my hand. I'll never forget that. And so that's kind of, you know, what led up to this. But it was a very grave moment for the country. And of course, I was sitting in the Capitol and had to evacuate that morning with a few members of the Black Caucus and the administrator of the Small Business Administration. And we had to evacuate at 8:15, 8:30. Little did I know why, except get out of here. Look back, saw the smoke, and that was the Pentagon that had been hit. But also on that plane on flight 93, which was coming into the Capitol, my chief of staff, Sondre Swanson, his cousin was Wanda Green, one of the flight attendants on flight 93. And so during this week, of course, I've been thinking about everyone who lost their lives, the communities that still haven't recovered. And those heroes and sheroes on flight 93 who took that plane down could have saved my life and saved the lives of those in the Capitol. So it was, you know, a very sad moment. We were all grieving. We were angry. We were anxious. And everyone, of course, wanted to bring terrorists to justice, including myself. I'm not a pacifist, so no, I'm the daughter of a military officer. But I do know my dad was in World War II in Korea, and I know what war, getting on a war footing means. And so I'm not one to say, let's use the military option as the first option, because I know we can deal with issues around war and peace and terrorism in alternative ways.
So what happened after you came off the floor of the House, giving that momentous 2-minute speech and going back to your office? What was the reaction?
Well, I went back into the cloakroom and everyone ran back to get me. And I remember most members, only 25% of members in 2001 are currently serving now, mind you. But there's still many serving. And they came back to me and out of friendship said, you have got to change your vote. It wasn't anything like, what's wrong with you? Or don't you know you have to be united? Because this was the pitch. You have to be united with the president. We can't politicize this. It's got to be Republicans and Democrats. But they didn't come at me like that. They said, Barb, one member said, you know, you're doing such great work on HIV and AIDS. This was when I was in the middle of working with Bush on the global PEPFAR and the Global Fund. You're not going to win your reelection. We need you here. Another member said, don't you know harm is going to come your way, Barbara? We don't want you hurt. You know, you need to go back and change that vote. Several members came back to say, are you sure? You know, you voted no. Are you sure? And then one of my good friends, and she said this publicly, Congresswoman Lynn Woolsey, she and I talked, and she said, you got to change your vote, Barbara. She said, even my son, she told me her family said, this is a hard time for the country. And even myself, you know, we've got to be unified and we're going to vote. You need to change your vote. So, and it was only out of concern for me that members came to ask me to change my vote. Now, later, my mother said it. My late mother said, they should have called me, she said, because I would have told them that after you deliberated in your head and talked to people, if you come to a decision, that you're pretty bullheaded and pretty stubborn. And it's going to take a lot to get you to change your mind, but you don't make these decisions easily. She said, you're always open. My mother told me that. She said, they should have called me. I would have told them. So then I walked back to the office and my phone started ringing. Of course, I looked up at the television and there was a, you know, little ticker saying one no vote. And one, I think one reporter would say, I wonder who that was. And then my name showed up. And so, well, so I started walking back to my office. Phone started blowing up. The first call was from my dad, lieutenant. In fact, in his latter years, he wanted me to call him Colonel Tut. He was so proud of being in the military. He, again, World War II, he was in the 92nd Battalion, which was the all-African-American battalion in Italy, supporting the Normandy invasion, okay? And then he later went to Korea, and he was the first person to call me. And he said, do not change your vote. That was the right vote, because I had not talked to him beforehand. I wasn't sure. I said, nah, I ain't going to call daddy yet. I'm talking to my mother. He says, you do not send our troops in harm's way. He said, I know what war is like. I know what it does to families. He said, you don't know where they're going. What are you doing? How's the Congress going to just put them out there without any strategy, without a plan, without Congress knowing at least what the heck is going on? So he said, that's the right vote. You stick with it. And he was really, and so I felt really happy about that. I felt really proud. But the death threats came. You know, I can't even tell you the details of how horrible it is. People did some awful things during that time to me. But it's just Maya Angelou said, and still I rise. And we just keep going. And the letters and the emails and the phone calls that were very hostile and hateful and calling me a traitor and said I committed an act of treason. They're all at Mills College, my alma mater. But also there were, I'd say 40% of those communications, there's 60,000, 40% are very positive. Bishop Tutu, Coretta Scott King, I mean, people from all around the world sent some very positive messages to me. And since then, and I'll close by just sharing this one story, because this is after the fact, just a couple of years ago, as many of you know, I supported Kamala Harris for president. So I was in South Carolina as a surrogate at a big rally, security everywhere. And this tall, big white guy with a little kid comes through the crowd, right? With tears in his eyes. What in the world is this? He came up to me and he said, I was one of those who sent you a threatening letter. I was one of those. And he went down all of what he said to me. I said, I hope the cops don't hear you saying this. But he was one who threatened me. He said, and I came here to apologize. And I brought my son here because I wanted him to see me tell you how sorry I am and how right you were. And just know that this is a day for me that I've been waiting for. And so I've had, over the years, many, many people have come in different ways to say that. And so that's what kept me going in a lot of ways, knowing that, you know, because of Win Without War, because of the Friends Committee, because of IPS, because of our Veterans for Peace and all of the groups that have been working around the country, organizing, mobilizing, educating the public, people really have begun to understand what this was about and what it means. And so I just have to thank everybody for circling the wagons, because it was not easy. But because all of you were out there, people come up to me now and say nice things and support me with a lot of love.
Well, Congressmember Lee, now it is 20 years later, and President Biden has pulled the U.S. troops out of Afghanistan. He's being fiercely attacked by both Democrats and Republicans for the chaos of the last few weeks. And there's been Congress is calling an inquiry into what happened. But do you think that inquiry should extend to the whole 20 years of the longest war in U.S. history?
I think we need an inquiry. I don't know if it's the same one, but first of all, let me say, I was one of the few members who got out there early supporting the president. He made the absolute correct decision. And in fact, I know that if we stayed there militarily for another 5, 10, 15, 20 years, we'd be probably in a worse place, because there's no military solution in Afghanistan and we can't nation build. That's a given. And so while it was difficult for him, we talked a lot about this during the campaign. And I was on the drafting committee of the platform. And you can go back and kind of look at what both Bernie and the Biden advisors on the platform came up with. So it was promises made, promises kept. And he knew that this was a hard decision. He did the right thing. But having said that, yes, the evacuation was really rocky in the beginning. And there was no plan. I mean, I don't guess. It didn't appear to me to be a plan. We did not know. Even I don't think the Intelligence Committee, at least it was faulty or inconclusive intelligence, I assume, about the Taliban. And so there were a lot of holes and gaps that we're going to have to learn about. We have an oversight responsibility to find out, first of all, what happened as it relates to the evacuation, even though it was remarkable that so many, what, over 120,000 people were evacuated? I mean, come on, in a few weeks? I think that is an unbelievable evacuation that took place. Still, people are left there, women and girls. We've got to secure, make sure they're secure and make sure there's a way to help with their education and get every American out, every Afghan ally out. So there's still more work to do, which is going to require a lot of diplomatic many diplomatic initiatives to really accomplish that. But finally, let me just say, you know, the special inspector for Afghanistan reconstruction, he's come out with reports over and over and over again. And the last one, I just want to read a little bit about what the last one just came out a couple of weeks ago. He said, we were not equipped to be in Afghanistan. He said, this was a report that outlined the lessons learned and aimed to pose questions to policymakers rather than making new recommendations. The report also found that the United States government, and this is in the report, did not understand the Afghan context, including socially, culturally, and politically. Additionally, and this is the SIGAR, the Special Inspector General, he said that the U.S. officials rarely even had a mediocre understanding of the Afghan environment. I'm reading this from the report, and much less how it was responding to U.S. interventions, and that this ignorance often came from a willful disregard for information that may have been available. So, and he's been, these reports have been coming out for the last 20 years. We've been having hearings and forums and trying to make them public because they are public. And so, yes, we need to go back and do a deep dive and a drill down, but we also need to do our oversight responsibilities in terms of what just recently happened so that it'll never happen again, but also so that the last 20 years when we conduct our oversight of what happened will never happen again either.
And finally, in this part of the evening, especially for young people, what gave you the courage to stand alone against war?
Well, I'm a person of faith, first of all. I pray. Secondly, I'm a Black woman in America, and I've been through a heck of a lot in this country, like all Black women. My mother, and I have to share this story because it started at birth. I was born and raised in El Paso, Texas. And my mother she needed a C-section and went to the hospital. They wouldn't admit her because she was Black. And it took a heck of a lot for her finally to be admitted into the hospital, a lot. And by the time she got in, it was too late for a C-section. And they just left her there. And someone saw her. She was unconscious. And then they, you know, just saw her laying in the hall. They just put her on, she said, a gurney and left her there. And so finally, they didn't know what to do. And so they took her into, and she told me it was an emergency room. It wasn't even the delivery room. And they ended up trying to figure out how in the world they were going to save her life, because by then she was unconscious. And so they had to pull me out of my mother's womb using forceps. You hear me? Forceps. So I almost didn't get here. I almost couldn't breathe. I almost died in childbirth. My mother almost died having me. So, you know, as a child, I mean, what can I say? If I had the courage to get here and my mother had the courage to birth me, I guess everything else is like no problem.
Well, Congressmember Lee, it's been a pleasure talking to you, a member of the House Democratic leadership, the highest ranking California Congressmember Barbara Lee. Yes, now in her 12th term, she is the highest ranking African-American woman in Congress. In 2001, September 14th, just 3 days after the 9/11 attacks, she was the sole member of Congress to vote against military authorization, the final vote 420-1. When I interviewed her Wednesday evening, she was in California campaigning in support of Governor Gavin Newsom ahead of this Tuesday's recall election, along with Vice President Kamala Harris, who was born in Oakland. Barbara Lee represents Oakland. On Monday, Newsom will campaign with President Joe Biden. This is Democracy Now! Stay with us. Remember Rockefeller at Attica by Charles Mingus. The Attica prison uprising began 50 years ago. Then on September 13, 1971, then New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller ordered armed state troopers to raid the prison. They killed 39 people, including prisoners and guards. On Monday, we'll look at the Attica uprising on the 50th anniversary. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. This week marks the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. On the morning of September 11, 2001, Democracy Now! Was on the air in our downtown firehouse studios at DCTV, Downtown Community Television, when the World Trade Center was attacked. We were the closest national broadcast to Ground Zero.
The latest news we have is that there have been widespread attacks that include at least three commercial jet crashes. We now believe perhaps four, three commercial jet crashes into significant buildings. In the first attack, a plane hit the North Tower of the World Trade Center in Manhattan shortly before 9 o'clock, followed by another plane into the second tower about 20 minutes later. Both towers later collapsed. About an hour later, a plane crashed into the Pentagon, part of which later collapsed.
That was just a part of our many-hour broadcast. We just didn't go off the air on that day for at least 6 hours. We were just doing radio at the time. Democracy Now! Closely followed the fallout from the 9/11 attacks, both at home and abroad. And I warn our listeners and viewers, the images are graphic. This is about violence. Today, we go back 20 years and revisit a remarkable conversation that I had with two New Yorkers, Rita Lazar and Masuda Sultan. Rita Lazar lost her brother Abe Zalmanowicz on the 27th floor of the World Trade Center. He worked at Blue Cross Blue Shield. He refused to leave until emergency workers came to help rescue his best friend, Ed, who worked next to him. He was a paraplegic. They died along with so many others. A few days later, President Bush invoked Abe's story in a speech at the National Cathedral in Washington, calling him a hero. His sister Rita wrote a letter to the New York Times urging Bush not to bomb Afghanistan. She wrote, "It is in my brother's name and mine that I pray that we, this country that has been so deeply hurt, not do something that will unleash forces we will not have the power to call back," she said. And that's exactly what happened a few weeks later. Untold thousands have died in the two decades since then. In Afghanistan, among them, the family of Masuda Sultan. She was an Afghan woman living in New York at the time of the 9/11 attacks. She soon got word that 19 members of her family had been killed in a U.S. bomb attack in Afghanistan. They'd moved to a farmhouse outside Kandahar to escape the U.S. attacks. It was there that they were bombed. When Masuda Sultan and Rita Lazar met in our studio in January 2002, Masuda had just returned from Afghanistan, where she had met with surviving members of her family. We began the conversation with the report she did for Democracy Now! As she made her way from Afghanistan to Pakistan while investigating the bombing. Rita and Masuda sat and listened to the report we replayed for them. Masuda had just returned. We were playing the tape of her in Afghanistan as she traveled, calling in from a dirt road.
We went over there last night. I had heard that there was some devastation. My family, I have some cousins that live in Kandahar, and the extended family is about 55 people. They lived right near some Taliban controlled compounds and buildings, and they anticipated that once the U.S. bombing campaign started, they wouldn't be safe any longer where they were. They decided to move out to some farmland they had about 50 miles outside of Kandahar City, and were staying there in order to stay safe. One evening at about midnight, while they were sleeping, they heard some loud noises outside and realized that their area was being bombed. Some rockets hit nearby, and they decided they had to leave their rooms. As they were running outside of their rooms, some of them were wounded by rockets. Some of them were being shot at. They described the scene where they were running with their kit in their arms, dodging bullets left and right while they had, well, they saw balls of fire falling down to the earth. They had no idea what was going on, and they were just running in any which direction for their lives. Some of them hid under an area that was covered, and some of them heard word of their loved ones falling to the ground as they were
talking to Masuda Sultan, who's describing how her family members were killed by the U.S. bombs that fell on the farmhouse they were taking refuge in outside of Kandahar. She's speaking to us from Afghanistan.
There were women and children running for their lives, being shot at by a helicopter hovering over their homes. And these people were not Taliban supporters. They weren't Al-Qaeda fighters. They were simple Afghans trying to stay safe in their own country. The events of September 11th really made me angry, but seeing these people and what they went through make me angry as well. You know, they say that in war, they say that you have to break a couple of eggs in order to make an omelet, but when those eggs are your family, what can you do?
How many members of your family were killed in the bombing?
19 members of that extended family were killed. There were many women and children in that 19, and we were shown some of the pictures as well. And we met the children that became orphans or that lost their mothers. One of them was a little girl that was a year and a half old, and she had been drinking breast milk, and they were having trouble with her getting used to the powdered milk. But it's just, when you see the faces of those little children and they tell you the story of how their mother died on their lap, with the blood flowing out of their head, and they ran, and they ran for their lives. It breaks your heart. It breaks your heart to know that this is the collateral damage of war.
That was Masuda Sultan calling into Democracy Now! From Afghanistan at the end of 2001. She'd returned to her native country because she'd learned that 19 members of her family had been killed in the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan soon after the September 11th attacks. We're going to miss our break today as we move forward. A few months later, in January 2002, we were joined by Masuda Sultan, just returned from Afghanistan, and another New Yorker. We were joined by Rita Lazar for the first time. Rita Lazar, at the time 70 years old, lost her brother Abe Zalmanowicz on the 27th floor of the World Trade Center. They sat and listened to Masuda's report in Afghanistan. She had just returned from there. When we talked to Rita and Masuda to talk about what happened on that morning of September 11th, 2001, to her brother.
I was listening to the radio, and the newscaster broke in to say that a plane had hit one of the World Trade Center buildings, and I thought, gee, what an accident. And I live on the 15th floor and ran to my neighbor's house, and she has a clear view of downtown Manhattan. And I looked out her window and saw the second plane hit the second building. And it dawned on me, my brother works there. My brother's in that building. And I sort of went crazy. And then I went about the day doing what all those other people did, calling every hospital, trying to find out if he had been brought to a hospital. I went down to the hospitals to see if his name was on a list. And then I realized he had died. And because he had stayed behind to stay with his quadriplegic brother, friend, who couldn't get out, although he was on the 27th floor and he could have saved himself, he died.
How do you know that? How do you know that?
He was on the phone with my other brother and my sister-in-law, and he said, "Don't worry, we're waiting for the firemen to come, and as soon as they come, they're going to help Ed and me get out of here." Ed was in a wheelchair and could not move. But by the time the firemen came, the building collapsed, and it was too late. And then President Bush mentioned him in the National Cathedral speech and cited him as being a hero. And I realized that my government was going to use my brother as justification for killing other people. And that had a tremendous impact on me. I didn't want that to happen, not in my brother's name. And so I wrote a letter to the Times, which they printed, asking our government to please be cautious and not do something they couldn't take back. And then I was asked to speak at a peace rally, and I did it. And just before I went on, I was told they had started bombing Afghanistan. And I realized something I had never realized before. I'd heard the term collateral damage all my life. It was always used about people far away from us. And I realized now what it meant, because my brother was collateral damage in a war that he didn't want and Masuda's people didn't want. And I knew I had to do something, but I didn't know what. And then I got a call from this wonderful woman from this marvelous organization called Global Exchange. And she said, "Would you like to go to Afghanistan and meet people like you who have lost their families?" And I thought, that's perfect, because Masuda and I are the same. There's no difference between us. My family member died. I'm grieving. And her family, God, I don't know how you survive just hearing about yours. But we're the same people. And so I'm going to Afghanistan. I'm going to see the people who have been left behind while their families died, with three other people who have lost family members, either in the plane that went down in Pennsylvania, or the Pentagon, or the World Trade Center. And we're going to come back here, and we're going to try to get the American public to open its heart and its wallet for your people the way they have done for us, and try to get our government to understand that bombing is not the solution.
Masuda, you've never met Rita Lazar before. You've just come back from Afghanistan, where Rita is headed to right now. You've had a week of reflection, and you've come back, well, to ground zero. You left from ground zero, and you've come back. What are your thoughts now? And if you could talk about how it was for you to meet with your family members.
First of all, I want to express my condolences to Rita. I did before, but I think your brother is a hero, and you're a hero for continuing his legacy. And it's amazing to me that someone who's lost so much isn't as revenge hungry as some of the other people that seem to want to, you know, go start bombing, you know, whoever, wherever, you know. A lot of this is about revenge, I feel, because especially having seen the faces of the people there and realizing that these are the farthest things from the enemy that, you know, we could find. granted, the American bombing campaign has been, I think, even with the death toll in my extended family and some of the other cases, I don't think that the U.S. government intended to bomb, you know, to carpet bomb the area. But I'm still trying to figure out what's going on. On the one hand, I think the United States government didn't intend to do some of this. On the other hand, I can't believe they did it, and who would make such a stupid mistake? And to be honest, I'm still a little confused about things.
Your family left an area in Kandahar, where you come from, and actually took refuge in a farmhouse so that they would not be bombed.
It's the irony is the saddest part of all of this. In Kandahar, they lived right next to Taliban-controlled buildings, and they knew, they anticipated that the United States was going to bomb those types of areas. So they left the city and fled to a desert. We took that same trip, and it was about an hour and a half to 2 hours outside of the city of Kandahar. And it was literally the middle of nowhere. We actually got lost getting out, and it took us about 3 hours to find our way back to the main road. The irony is that they left that area thinking they would be safe in this desert because there's no Taliban there. And ironically, that's where they were hit.
When you went to the Marine base in Kandahar and ask them why they bombed your family, what was the response?
The Marine that I spoke to told me that they hadn't, that particular group, the Marines, had only been in Kandahar Airport after the incident, so he didn't have information for me. He told me that I should speak to the State Department. Privately, some of the Marines did express their condolences. And what shocked me was what I sensed coming from them was a sort of confusion about why they were there. I asked one of them why they were in Kandahar, I think, which is a valid question. Why are you willing to risk your life here? And he said, "We're here to oust the Taliban." And I looked at him and said, "But the Taliban have been in power since 1996. Is that, do you feel comfortable being here to oust the Taliban? Doesn't it sound kind of odd?" And he really couldn't answer my question, and I could sense the discomfort he felt. And it's scary that there are people that will fight, in the name of something they don't really understand. I love the United States. I grew up here. I came here at the age of 5, and I feel, as American as anyone else. But and I would fight for my country gladly. But I don't know if the mission is really clear and if the intent is honorable.
Masuda, after the World Trade Center attacks and occurred on September 11th, and then all of the information or non-information started to come out, and it became clear that the U.S. was making Afghanistan a target, what were your feelings at the time?
When September 11th happened, and I watched those buildings collapse, and I thought about all those people in there like Rita's brother, I was angry. I was angry just as any New Yorker. And my immediate feeling was, who are the jerks that did this, and what are we going to do about it? And I went down there that first week and actually got through some police barricades and watched what was going on and volunteered for a few hours. But my immediate reaction was anger and shock. But that same day, I sensed that something like this was not going to go unpunished. I mean, I would want to figure out who did it, too. I realized that Osama was probably in some way responsible, and that the United States was probably, you know, going to do something about that. And guess what? Osama's in Afghanistan. And that day, I started making phone calls on September 11th to family here in New York to tell them to also call some family back in Afghanistan to sort of alert people to the fact that this may happen. And some of them didn't think that it would go that far. And they said, oh, you're being, you know, you're being too cautious. And as, you know, as time and the events sort of unfolded, that's exactly what happened. And something like this probably shouldn't go unpunished, but who do we punish is really the question. And how do we punish them? And I don't think that what the United States is doing in Afghanistan is really what they set out to do. In the beginning, I was actually hoping that if they got the perpetrators in Afghanistan, that the people of Afghanistan would finally be freed. They were also held hostage by the Taliban and Al-Qaeda for the last number of years. They suffered at the hands of these people. And now, again, are suffering at the hands of these people who have come and essentially, in my view, Al-Qaeda has invaded Afghanistan, has taken control, and is now using it as their war zone. And again, it's sort of what happened when the Soviets invaded, and it was the proxy war. I mean,
and your family members are not alive to enjoy the freedom, if there will be.
Some of them have survived. It was really difficult to... I was asked by a lot of people there, both my family and other people that had lost possessions and people in some of the bombings, what the United States was going to do about it. And I thought about, you know, how September 11th funds were everywhere and how great that was and how much the American people opened their hearts to the victims of September 11th. And then I thought about, and the United States government as well. And then I thought about, what about these people who, you know, for some reason or other got caught in the middle of all of this, lost lives, lost children, you know, lost property. Who do they ask, you know, for help? Who do they turn to?
Well, it seems like Rita Lazar has taken up that banner with a few other people. Unfortunately, your message doesn't get out very much in the mainstream media. The stories of people like your brother, heroes at the World Trade Center, are heard. But when you then take the next step and say, though you do not think that war is the answer, that's not the part of the story that we hear. A New York Times photograph showed people who walked from Washington to New York saying, not in our name. And the photograph just said people who are mourning their loved ones at the World Trade Center and Pentagon.
We're hoping by going to Afghanistan, members who have lost their loved ones and showing that we understand that people in Afghanistan, as well as we, are mourning and hurting and are innocent, just as my brother and I are innocent. We're hoping that this will get more coverage than it has. And we're hoping that, just as Masuda said, the September 11th fund was a generous, more than generous, acknowledgement of our loss, that there will be an equal Afghanistan fund from the American people and from our government to help those people.
Rita Lazar and Masuda Sultan, speaking in Democracy Now! Studios in January of 2002. Rita died in 2017. She lost her brother Abe Zalmanowicz in the World Trade Center attack. She would become an active member of the September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. Masuda Sultan was born in Kandahar, Afghanistan. She lost 19 members of her family in a U.S. bombing raid in Afghanistan soon after the U.S. attacked in October 2001. She would later write her memoir, My War at Home. Reporters packed into our little studios just blocks from Ground Zero to see this momentous meeting. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.